Hey, just wanted to let you know that we have exclusive content that you can access if you're one of our Patreon subscribers. If you want to join our Patreon team, head over to patreon.com/shotoftruthpodcast. Any donation will give you access to the mini episode that includes more about the palm reading that we reference in the show. And we hope that you enjoy Stuck in Chicago, Lines of Affirmation. My name is Victoria Matei.
My name is Olga Araceli.
And we are both undocumented women of color. All right. Okay. So welcome back to A Shot of Truth podcast. This is actually a really exclusive episode, considering that a couple of us that are here recording today are kind of here by accident. We are in Chicago and got stuck here overnight. So we were just brainstorming things that we wanted to do and decided we wanted to share just some of our experiences and take advantage of this opportunity to record. Unfortunately, Olga's not here. I know she joined us at the last episode, but, you know, she's out there doing her thing, and I wasn't just going to let this opportunity go, and I'm really excited about who we're recording with today, and we prepared a pretty exclusive and awesome episode, so we hope you enjoy, and yeah, fuck yeah, we're in Chicago. What do you have to say? Let's introduce yourselves.
Hi, everyone. My name is Yuriana. I am undocumented woman from Bellevue, Washington. I work there and originally from Eastern Washington. So shout out to Royal City.
So thanks, Yuriana, for joining us. We also have our friend Steve here, who is also part of the Dream Lead Institute. So Steve, let's hear it. What do you have to say?
Hey, everyone. This is Steve, an immigrant from Lima, Peru. And part of the Dream Lead Institute, which has been an awesome experience that I've been in. And that's where we met.
Yeah. Before we go into kind of what we laid out, I want to know, just share with everybody, how did we all meet? Because we met separately, but I don't know. How did we meet?
Yeah. So, I grew up in Washington, and I've had a really long experience with organizing, and I've had a really long experience with particularly in education, trying to make sure that undocumented students had more access to college. And so I feel that really how we met and our introduction to ourselves started when we were organizing or being vocal about being undocumented. And so particularly with Bicky, I knew about Bicky because just similar friend groups, and particularly I had heard a lot about Blue Group, which is the undocumented student club at Western. And I, at the time that I went to UW, started with Purple Group. And Purple Group met once a month, and they came and they talked about everything, and they gave each other hacks. But the one thing about Purple Group is that at the time, they wanted to be a secret group. So they don't want anybody to know that we existed. And, people had different feelings in the group.
Yeah, and that's totally fair.
Yeah, and then, they were there because each of them needed something different from the group. And this is a time, I think, definitely before DACA, definitely before state aid. We had HB 1079. But that's it. Really, undocumented students didn't have a lot. And so who we relied to and even who we trusted was very different. Mm-hmm. And so Purple Group was that connection for me. And so a few years later, we hear that Blue Group is starting at Western. And just so you know, the colors represent the school that we go to. So UW is purple and gold, and Western is blue and white.
That's right.
Yeah, that's correct.
You were looking for me, yeah, that's what it is. Yeah.
And so that's what they meant, right? So it was a secret name where we didn't have to say that we were dreamers or we had to be undocumented. It was just how do we define ourselves so that we don't look obvious to other people? and, you know, like an obvious group of undocumented students at UW. And so and what was really cool was that, like, then that movement started spreading to other colleges. And so when Blue Group kind of surfaced, I was just so excited because for the first time we had seen a group of undocumented students be so vocal about change in the campus. And so that's the first time that I had heard about you. And then on the other side with Steve, so I actually was a fan of Steve.
I'm a fan of Steve too. Steve is great.
Oh, I'm fine with all of you.
This is before I knew Steve. And Steve for me was like, okay, California is doing some badass shit. They're being out, they're being undocumented, unafraid, unapologetic. And I was like, damn, like that's really good. And so the first time that I saw or heard of Steve was in a video. And this was with Dreamers Adrift. And he said that he's undocumented as a Peruvian Asian, right? And so for me, that was like, oh my God, mind blown, intersectionality. Like, yes, you know, do it. And I need to show this to the world. And so I started using his video in my trainings.
How do you feel about that, Steve?
No, that's dope. I think that that was one of the intentions behind that video and film with Julio Salgado, Jesus, Blanca. We were walking down the street one day and we were talking. I was talking about how I had this, I always have this crazy experience because of the, I am multinational, multicultural, multilingual, and how that really plays out in funny ways in my life. And I really wanted to share that experience. And I shared that experience with them. And they were like, we should totally make this into a video. Like, there's other people who might relate to this. And it's such a valuable lesson that you don't know where someone comes from.
And what I love about the video is that it's quick and to the point. And it's funny. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel like people can relate more to some kind of comedy, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's also, like, real, right? Like, yeah. It's authentic as fuck. This is a reality that a lot of people don't think about. Or it's not like... Like, when you think of undocumented, you don't think of Latinx Asian folks.
Yeah.
At all.
Yeah. And... you really reminded me, Urianna, of the date when this was shot back in 2011. Like
that was crazy. I can't believe. So I honestly thought that it was like in 2015, because for you to be doing something like that in 2011, and that was published in 2011. I'm assuming that was filmed this before.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Like we were so afraid of being out.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we still did like these like radical things like where you're like, you know what, fuck up all of you, like you don't really get to decide what I get to be as just like, you know, like a person with many different intersectionalities.
Yeah. And that was really the video really the intention behind it too. I think for me was that there's so much joy in that experience as well, having had the opportunity to be a migrant, not once, but twice. And there's just so much packed in there in one small time frame I'm glad and I was so grateful for you to tell me that other people are watching this because it really, the mission of that intention, you're telling me that it was affected by someone, so it was great.
It was impactful.
And it was accessible too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's easily accessible through YouTube, and we'll link it on our show notes as well. But Steve, I kind of want to hear about, like, how you're saying you're multinational, multicultural, multilingual. Like, what has that experience been for you? And, I mean, you could even kind of describe the video a little bit, because that is a perfect example of all of those things.
Yeah, so... I was born in Lima, Peru, and I came to the United States in 2002, around 2002, because of a lot of political turbulences and instability in Peru, my parents decided to migrate to the United States for a better opportunity and a better life for us. And before Peru, just to let all the listeners know that my ethnicity is Chinese. My parents were born in China, they lived in China, and my grandparents from my dad's side ended up in Peru to in search of better opportunities as well. And they owned a restaurant in Peru. But one day something happened and the restaurant burned down, and it was my grandparents who were hospitalized because of that. So my dad, being the oldest son in the family, in Chinese culture, is like, you have to take care of your parents. And it was, in a way, it was kind of a force on him to have to migrate to Peru from China, where he was a principal and my mom was a teacher. And that's how they met in school. And to migrate to Peru, that was forced migration for certain circumstances. And that forced migration was because my grandparents were searching for their opportunities in Peru. So it's just very interesting of this, all these different poles of migrations coming to all different countries, but they have a common thread of just searching for better opportunities for the next generation.
I think forced migration is such a thing that a lot of people don't see. People think that, you know, we immigrate to other countries because, you know, we have like some like want or like just like a joy of migrating to other countries. But really, the reality is it's forced migration. It's forced migration to survive, to like have a better life, to have a better economy, to give your kids a better life. People don't ever take that into consideration.
Yeah. And a lot of this stems from kind of what is accessible to people with information too, right? Because this whole picture is painted in the media that that's not the reality, that people are coming here against, you know, they're coming here because they want your jobs, et cetera. So I don't know. It's hard for people to see that, but it definitely is. I think U.S. policies have made this what happens not just to Mexico, but so many countries in the world. I want to kind of ask you a little bit about, like, have you had experiences where there's people talking shit about you in Spanish and you're standing there and you're like, bitch, I can understand you. Like, yeah. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. So to answer that question, I don't have people talk shit behind me, because they will say it in front of me in whatever language that will take.
I wasn't expecting that.
Okay.
Or I hope that happens. But often the gossip that I overhear is like, well, the example that I always go to is the first memory that I had when that happened was at a bus, when I was taking a bus somewhere. And these two ladies were just talking about their husbands. They were talking about their kids, their family, whatever. And they were talking really intimate things, like someone slept with someone, or like there's this drama with someone's aunt and uncle.
That sounds juicy. That sounds really juicy.
There's a moment where we both make eye contact. We like looked at each other, and he was like, and they gave me a look that meant, oh, he doesn't understand what we're saying. Because they were like, there's just this time where you're like, look around to see if there's anyone there.
Yeah.
And then you keep talking. That moment happened. And I was mind blown. I'm like, yeah, keep talking. And this is very entertaining. So that's what happened. And that's where that experience came for that video.
And Yuriana said,
"That's
some
good chisme, man.
That is some good chisme.
I know some good chisme. And now I'm going to the next level."
Steve, I had asked you earlier, you know, like, what is something that you want to share with people? Like, what are you proud of within yourself? And I was really like interested in what you had to say. Do you want to share a little bit?
Yeah, definitely. Something that I'm very proud of, I think, is I look back and I'm very proud of how independent I've become. And this independence, and you asked me a clarifying question. this independence was forced. I say that I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it because being an immigrant, I think from my own experience, being a child of immigrants, a lot of my dependency has been on my parents making decisions for me, my parents migrating to another country for me, my parents just taking care of all the little things that you've never thought of. And I think, and I say that it was forced because when I was very young, I will have nightmares about being separated from my family, from my parents, from my mom specifically. This was back when I was in Peru. This was back when I was 7 or 6. And in 2010, I was put into deportation proceedings during my first year of college when I was attending City College of San Francisco. And they detained me. In the morning of September when I was just getting ready to go to school, that freshman year, there was a loud knock on the door. And
wait, was this, did you live off campus, on campus? Did you live with your family?
I lived with my parents.
Okay.
I lived with my mom at that time because my parents were separated at that time. So I lived with my mom and this was around 7 a.m. There was a loud knock on the door. And then no one knocks at the door at 7 a.m. in my household. Like, we don't know anyone. So I woke up my mom and I was like, someone's knocking outside, like, really loudly. Like, we have never heard someone knock like that at all. And she goes and answers the door and immediately starts to panic. And I've never seen my mom panic in her entire life. And between seconds, there were ICE agents all over my tiny apartments, my tiny in-law apartments. And that's the day that I found out that I was undocumented and that they were going to be deporting me. I will be detained and be deported back to Peru.
Wow.
And that was one of the most helpless I've felt in my life and powerless I've felt in my life. And saddest. Helpless and powerless because this was a moment where I had, where there was no say in it. There was all of a sudden I could be handcuffed and detained and be treated. All my freedoms were taken away at that moment. And I had no say in it at all.
And what ended up happening?
What ended up happening? One of the most painful moments of that experience was also seeing my mom being handcuffed. I think that was really a sight that I'll never forget, seeing, walking down the door and seeing my mom who have worked her entire life, who had work nights and who has sacrificed so much for me and my sister to have a better life and better opportunities, to be handcuffed and just treated like a criminal, treated like she did something wrong, that was really painful to see that. And the outcome of all of this was that during that time, I was going to college and I was taking my first Asian American class ever. And I met my professor and mentor, San Chi, and I had amazing friends and amazing mentors as well who rallied once they found out about the situation in San Francisco, and they really organized with the help of the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. To advocate on my behalf and advocate to Senator Dianne Feinstein, who ended up on the final day when I was detained, for about 60 days. I was detained for 2 months. I was in a detention center in Florence, Arizona for 2 months.
Wow.
My first year of college when I was early 20.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once I got handcuffed, I was immediately went to the ICE office, and immediately the day after I ended up in LA, and the day after I ended up in Arizona, and they were just shipping us in buses, in airplanes, seeing immigrants detained and shackled and handcuffed. That was the worst experience, and seeing that and recounting that experience has been painful and difficult that we treat people like that.
And how did you get out?
Thank you for reminding me to mention that I stopped when I said that they were organizing and really making noise in the media, in Yahoo News, getting local support from the supervisors of San Francisco for the education board, till it went to Washington, D.C. Just the day before I was going to be deported, they said I was after spending 60 days, I didn't know that if I was going to stay in the U.S. or go back to Peru. And the day before I was going to be deported, I heard my lawyer call me from the Asian Law Caucus and said, her name is Xinyuan, she's been amazing. And she called me and said that Senator Dianne Feinstein wrote a private bill on your behalf and your deportation has been halted.
Mm.
And this was not Senator Feinstein doing it because she felt bad about my situation. This was a community making noise and organizing that this was not right. And this is an injustice.
Yeah.
That I am able to be here today and talking to you all.
I like, honestly, Steve, I never knew any of that. And I'm telling you, I followed you for a really long time and I didn't know that. And that's like, I can't imagine that experience, but I want you to know, like, I'm with you. Like,
thank you.
Whatever you need, I got you. And I don't know. I'm just,
as I'm you sorry. Can tell,
that sucked. That probably sucked. Mm. And also the community got behind it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I'm sorry to be like, just like, you know, asking, but what ended up happening to your mom?
So after I was handcuffed and taken into custody, into the Sacramento County Jail, and then moved to Arizona, to the Central Center in Flores, Arizona, I heard that they ended up taking my mom and they went to the grocery store that my dad used to work in. And that's where they detained him. They didn't let him, they didn't let us take anything, any backpacks, anything from her house. They basically came in that morning and took all of us and detained us right away without us being able to take anything or let anyone know.
And this is where I'm telling you, like, ICE does not give a fuck about anybody. Like,
no.
They are a hateful organization. They don't care and they will mistreat people and they will take everyone. And yeah.
It's a system created to separate families and move families away from their loved one as fast as possible without anyone knowing, without the public and the media knowing, without society knowing of this mistreatment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that we need to really, really look into ourselves and ask ourselves how can we be humans and see this mistreatment? And how can we not believe that this is happening when there's so many facts and videos and people telling you that this keeps happening?
And stories, right? Of kids being killed and kids being separated and, like, kids not finding their way back home ever. Like, if you think about this, like, whole thing, you're right. Like, it's a system that is not there to protect families, and it's not there to protect people.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to paint that they're doing this to protect the American community, economy, all this bullshit.
And the majority of this is people of color. Is people of color. Mm-hmm. Is people of color.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, like,
wake up. Like, wake the fuck up. Like, all of this, yes, maybe the bugs on the ground, but, or the boots on the ground. That's what I meant. Boots on the ground. But you know who's, like, playing the system up here? Is the white supremacists, right? Like, the people who want to stay in power. Who pays detention centers? How many contracts go to detention centers? And to what companies does it go? Most of them are, like, bad politicians who are only there because they, like, are getting something out of it, right? They're becoming richer. They're becoming whatever. Exactly with the same government, federal government right now. Like, the only reason they're there is to get money. They're not there to care about us.
I
want to ask you again, because you didn't end up telling me what ended up happening with your mom. You kind of mentioned that you didn't know. No. It's fine. But I think you were kind of like circling around the question.
Thanks for getting me back in track. Is my mom, after being detained, she was deported with my dad. My parents were deported in 2010 because there was no Dream Act for this, because there was no Dream Act for them, because society demonized parents, because we were trying to paint a picture as well of what the good immigrant and the bad immigrant look like.
Exactly. Is there anything else that you kind of want to say about that? Because I have a couple more questions for you, Steve.
No, you should ask me the questions.
Okay. And, you know, I also want to recognize that you opening up and being vulnerable like that is a lot. So I'm curious to what a lot of people, specifically, you know, in our Dream Lead Institute, are going to think and say. But I know that they're thinking of you in this moment, and that you have so many people that love you, and like, not only that, but like the constant laughter that we have shared, the tears, the reflections, even just on this trip, right, has been so much. So thank you for sharing.
And I take it into my heart, just being with the company of all of you. So it means a lot.
I know. But at the last retreat, when we went to the Valley, which we did a whole episode on, you didn't attend. But in your check-in, you kind of mentioned like that there was a reason. Like, what was that reason? And it's totally, you know.
Yeah. I really was very bummed that I wasn't able to attend. But there were a couple of reasons, and I don't know which one will be the first, but I think the first one, just on the top of my mind, when we first mentioned that that's where we were going, I was scared, yeah, to be honest, after experiencing the trauma of being detained, mm-hmm. And going through that experience. I just, any type of possibility that will take me there again, I was not going to take that risk of if it's either like border patrol or if it's either something that happens in the border or whatnot. So I think that was the biggest one, I would say. But then also life happened with work and personal. So I didn't end up being able to attend, but I definitely send a lot of energy and vibes, and really, I love seeing you guys document it and experiencing it through that. So thank you.
I know, we're so annoying. All we do is take photos and like videos. I'm like, I'm living, like watching everything, living it again through everybody else.
And it's also like, it's just so beautiful that you like want to capture the moment. Like, I know I want to capture this with you guys, right?
Yeah. And we've done so many fun things even just this weekend. And like, even the fact that like, we're talking about, you know, the next few steps within our cohort and stuff is amazing because there's always something more. Before we move on and ask Yudiana about her life, Yudiana, what are we drinking?
So we are drinking a Voodoo Ranger IPA. And I believe it is from Chicago.
Is it?
It's cute. It has very cute image at the front. Yes.
So it's really funny because it's called Voodoo Ranger. And we literally just went to get our hands red, our palms red. So we got a little bit of the future.
And we have a whole like section ready for that too, to unpack that.
That's very magical.
But before we do that, Yudiana, I kind of want to hear a little bit about where you grew up in Washington, mm-hmm. and focus a little bit on that because you grew up in a predominantly like Latino farmworking community, kind of in a rural area where there is outside of that community, it's very, very conservative, mm-hmm. even though we live in this progressive Washington, right?
Yeah.
So what was that like?
Yeah. So before that, like really quick, so I was born in Michoacán, Mexico. And when I was eight, my dad was already in the U.S. because he typically would come to the U.S. along with my grandfather every summer to work. And cherries, apples, like you name it, he would do it. And so my dad was already in the U.S. and my mom and my two brothers were back in Mexico. And in the summer, something happened where my dad wasn't there to really like protect us because that's when a lot of the violence was happening in the U.S. or in Mexico, in Michoacán. And so my dad decided to bring my mom and my two brothers to the U.S.
Oh my gosh, no.
Yeah. And so, you know, my mom tells me and she's like, oh, you're going to stay with your grandmother. And, you know, and we'll be back soon. Like, I don't even think they had a plan for when they were going to be back. And obviously, yeah. Like, when you come, like, you stay. If things are better and if things are easier. And I was like, oh, heck no. Like, I'm smart enough to know that if you go, you're not going to come back. And so I cried. And I was like, no, like, I want to go with you. And then I was already eight, so, like, I had this concept of El Norte, right? And mm-hmm. I had this concept with, like, money grows on trees. And, like, you know, you have, like, all of these things, like nice things, right? Especially because my dad would come back in, like, November, December. And so usually he would bring gifts for us. And so I was like, I'm not dumb. I'm going to go with you guys. And so, like, when I talked to my dad on the phone as an eight-year-old, I was like, I don't want to stay here. Like, I want to go. And he said, okay. Like, my dad is, like, has, like, the biggest heart. Like, I don't think he would have been able to tell me.
No.
No, you can't come.
Mm-hmm.
And so he brought us over with the coyote through the border. And we came directly to Washington because that's where a lot of our family was. And we moved around a lot. So we lived in Yakima and Wapato, Toppenish, Sunnyside, and then eventually to Royal City. But I went to school in Wapato and Toppenish. And then Royal City, which was like a tiny, tiny town. Like, they usually say that if you drive past Highway 26 and you blink, you'll miss our town. And there's like one taqueria, like one grocery store, one high school, one middle school, one elementary school. So I grew up there. It was really calm, really quiet. And we knew we had about 75% Latinos. And so I never thought, like, yeah, like I knew I didn't have papers and I was undocumented. And then at the same time, there was 75% Latinos. And it was agriculture, so a lot of people were undocumented. Like, mm-hmm. you didn't really have to ask each other, right? And then even my peers who were white, they didn't really get to think about that, right? Like, we grew up in a farm worker, like, community. So a lot of the people who owned the farms were the white, rich people of the town. And then those who worked were immigrants, mostly undocumented. And so I knew that, like, in seventh grade, when somebody told me, I went to a college visit and somebody told me about House Bill 1079, I was like, okay, I'm going to go to college. And House Bill 1079 is the bill for undocumented students. So I worked really hard and I, like, tried to make sure I was involved in everything. My senior year, I was the ASB president.
Ooh. Yeah, and I was like, didn't know that.
And, you know, I, like, ran against one of my best friends at the time. Oh. I'm pretty sure she's not my friend anymore. But, like, you know, it was like I was very embedded in that community as somebody who wanted to succeed.
Yeah.
And when I applied to UW, it was January 2nd, and I remember the date. And I waited for my mom to get home from work so we can open it together. And it was in a just a white regular envelope. And if you ask anybody who's gone into UW, you know that you got into UW because they send you a big purple envelope.
Mm-hmm.
And the purple envelope, they have everything.
Wow.
But I got a white, plain, simple envelope. And then I turned it around and it said recycled in the back. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, I'm not even worth, like, a non-recycled paper. And, you know, we're in Royal City, so it's... Nobody knows about recycling.
We're in Royal City?
Like, nobody knows that Seattle's, like, freaking, you know, hyped about recycling. And so I wait for my mom to get home from work. And then I open it, and it says that I got it in. And so I start crying. My mom starts crying. And then she said, that's really good. I'm really proud of you, but you can't afford it, you know? And so that was kind of like the story. Like, I knew I was undocumented, and then yet, like, there was all these barriers.
Yeah.
And it was normal. Like, for our town, it was normal that, like, there was undocumented students not going to college. And then I opened it, and it said I was in, and eventually I got enough scholarships to go.
Yeah.
But when I got to UW, I was so upset. Like, I was super upset about, like, a lot of the undocumented students who I had gone to school with. I was upset that they didn't go to college. And I was upset that we had a lot of lost talent and a lot of people with dreams that didn't get to pursue their dreams. And I felt like the imposter syndrome. And I felt like, why me and not everybody else? I'm not more deserving than anybody else.
Yeah.
And so that's when I started getting involved.
Involved. I'm sorry, I just have a really quick question for Steve. Did you end up graduating with your bachelor's?
Yeah, I did. After my parents were deported in 2010, I knew that I wanted to keep their dreams and goals for me to finish college and graduate. I ended up attending University of California, Davis. And I graduated in 2015. And to this day, I think it's still, I am saddened that I did not have my parents for my graduation. I think this has, as much as I worked hard for that degree, it was also my parents for their sacrifice. But I had such a beautiful community of friends and mentors and family who, extended family who came to support me, that I feel loved. So yeah.
Yudiana, earlier we had talked a little bit about how we met with the HB 1079 conference, and I know that was something that you co-founded, and you know, it's something that is still ongoing and is still benefiting not only high school folks, but people in higher ed and just people, communities all over Seattle, and not even just Seattle, but Washington in general. So do you kind of want to talk about how you kind of thought of doing that? And I mean, I know that you probably poured your heart into getting this together. So tell us about it.
Yeah, so actually, it kind of goes back a little bit to the fact that I was really enraged with not enough undocumented students going to college.
Oh, yeah.
And it was upsetting to see that people didn't have answers. And it was upsetting to see that students were not going to school because they didn't have the right resources. Yeah, so when I finally got to UW, the first year, I got involved with the organization called Education Without Borders. And it was a student group organization that would mentor high school students. And then there was this project that was called, what's it called? It was a Mary Gates Leadership Scholarship. And I was like, oh, like, you know, like I'm out here like being undocumented, trying to hustle, trying to like get other people to pay for my college. And so I was like trying to find every single scholarship that I could do. And the Mary Gates Leadership Scholarship had a like project component to it. And so I was like, perfect. What project can I do? And then the idea of Beyond HB 1029 kind of came to fruition because I had been to a couple other conferences and they were STEM related. And I was like, what if we do this, but just for undocumented students? And so I ended up not applying to the scholarship because I missed the deadline.
Because you were too busy planning the conference.
Yeah, because I was too busy already implementing the project. And after I missed the deadline for the scholarship, I was like, well, like, we still need this. It doesn't mean that we don't need the information for undocumented students. And it doesn't mean that, like, people couldn't benefit from this. And so I was like, okay, perfect. We'll plan a conference with 40 people. You know, teachers, parents, and students are welcome to come. And this is just high school students in the Seattle area. And so we start planning and we start seeing all these registrations come in. And then literally the week of the conference, 227 applications came in. Mm. And all of a sudden, going from a mini conference of 40 people, we had to go to a conference of 227 people. And that was like a light bulb, right? Like, this is something that people have not seen before. Again, like, thinking in 2012, everything that's happening right now, like, yes, like, it's important. And then also recognize, like, a lot of people did not have the opportunity to be out about their undocumented status that time. Mm-hmm. The first time I stepped into a stage to say that I was undocumented was the most terrifying, like, experience that I've had, you know? And yet it was such an empowering experience as well to be like, I'm undocumented, I'm vulnerable, I'm here, what are you gonna do, you know? And so that was the conference. And then every year, we just kept doing the conference because people kept coming back. And I remember one of the evaluations of a student that was in high school. And she said, I thought I couldn't go to college, but now I know I can go to college. I don't care about like 227 people. If you make a difference in one person, the investment is worth it, you know?
Mm-hmm. So you saw the conference had like a huge impact on your community. Like, I'm assuming obviously it was a success considering it's still happening over and over again. And I, you know, am grateful that we were able to meet through it, as I think that was kind of when I was getting more involved in some of my public speaking. But I don't know. I also know that even though it had a huge impact on your community, it had a huge impact on your life and your career and the way you move forward. So mm-hmm. Do you quickly want to just mention a little bit about just that thinking process, right? Because you, like you were saying earlier, you're like, I could have gone and made the big bucks, but
yeah,
something else was more important.
Yeah, no. So my degree actually started off in engineering. And so I got my degree in human-centered design and engineering. But my life and my extracurricular was really organizing for undocumented students. And so the conference itself, because I was doing it every year, it built the connections and the almost the like unofficial dream space for undocumented students. And so as I transitioned, graduating from college, I started working for the university to specifically implement processes mm-hmm. that would help undocumented students at college mm-hmm. with the Ethnic Cultural Center. And then from there, you know, I worked 3 years there working with the students. I'm going to be honest with you. The most resilient students are undocumented students.
Say it again.
Like, yes, I am not even like kidding. Like,
say it to the people in the back.
The most resilient individuals are undocumented people mm-hmm. in every like sense of the word. So I worked for at UW for 3 years working with undocumented students there. And then I go to the East Coast to work with undocumented students in New Jersey. And the difference between the states it's a lot. Like in Washington, I felt so privileged. And even though I started college in an era where we didn't have financial aid and we didn't have like, you know, what is now, I did have the security that I would make it happen somehow, right? And I would have the security that would pay in-state tuition. Which in itself I recognize as a privilege because I knew that, right? Like, can you imagine how many undocumented people right now don't know that that exists? High school counselors don't know about it. You know, like teachers mm-hmm. don't know about it.
No.
Like, you have to really... Listen, this law passed in 2003. It's been how many years and you still don't know your freaking policies for undocumented students, even though you're working every day?
And that's just
bullshit.
It tells a lot about the educational system that people have to feed that kind of information for you about educational equity. Like it should be mandated or required for you to
have access
and get that information readily accessible when you need it the students.
And that always takes me back to something Olga said, and I can't get over it, but she says, like English does not mean knowledge, right? Mm-hmm. And because a lot of this stuff is not translated, it's not accessible in any way, shape, or form through location or language mm-hmm. or whatever, like we lose so many people.
Oh yeah.
And something I like recently did is I went up to one of the Western tables where they have like information about people visiting the campus, and I'm like, why isn't this translated?
Why you know is that this people not are translated? Coming. Why are but
exactly?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I appreciate that.
And what was something in New Jersey that just like struck you that you learned and that you took from that? Because you mm-hmm. made this journey across the fucking country by yourself.
Yeah. So it was most interesting. Like, and again, like Washington, I've been through like the different stages of Washington growing, but then you get to New Jersey, and it's like stepping 10 years back. And people don't talk about being undocumented. You know, you have your key leaders in mm-hmm. the community, but students do not talk about being undocumented. Students are afraid of talking about them being undocumented. The state law that allows for undocumented students to get state financial aid just passed this past year. Wow. So you're stepping back, right, in time.
A lot more than 10 years.
And then you're adding the dynamic of race. Because in New Jersey, like race is, like the racial disparities are very seen, especially in the undocumented community. I'll have, you know, every single race, every single ethnicity come to me. And Washington, you know, I could kind of gauge, right, like, I don't want to cookie cut it up, right? But usually you have the percentages of undocumented students mostly being Latino. And in New Jersey, you have so much diversity and you have so much different set of experiences. And so, for example, I'll tell you this example without telling you any names, right? I had one student who had been abandoned at age 15 in Newark, New Jersey, and didn't have any sort of official legal guardian. And she was trying to go to college, and she was an African undocumented person. Mm-hmm. Can you, like, just think of all the different layers that that has? Like, it's just the experiences there was like going back in time and saying, we need to do something. Like, we need to pass policy. We need to pass procedures. And we need to stop thinking that being undocumented means Y or X, right? Like, we need to say, like, being undocumented is, like, is us being undocumented, and it's something that is happening in this country. And unless you recognize it, and unless you put the human to it, you will never see us. You will never see us as people.
And, you know, that brings us, we had a whole episode on identity and some people identifying as undocumented, some people feeling that being pushed on their identity and not really a part of their identity. But we see, and, you know, where people end up going from undocumented to having some kind of residency.
Yeah.
And what psychological shit is happening there, right?
Because
that is changing your life.
Yeah. So just really quick, in New Jersey, people don't say undocumented. They, like, code it differently, right? Like, say you
what
say
do they
dreamer.
Say?
Or you say, you know, you say, like, other things. Like, but saying I'm undocumented, it takes so much from people.
And definitely.
In addition to that, like, I had, even in differences in age, right? Like, I had a lot of people in their 30s as freshman students because, you know, because the laws are just passing. People are like, oh, now I can go back to school. And they graduated in 2003. I had one woman who had graduated in 2003, 2002, and was finally coming back to college because now she had the opportunity to.
Yeah, and when you go back to that word about being undocumented and a dreamer, that experience, I think, is, thank you for sharing that, but it's also still relevant to some spaces that I'm in today. And that when I say that I'm undocumented, other people will refer me as a dreamer, even though they have heard me refer myself as undocumented. So it's something that I guess people are still uncomfortable in saying, or something that we need to continue to empower or kind of shift the narrative of what it means to be undocumented.
Yeah, and you know, me personally, I'll tell you that, like, I am not your dreamer. I am not anybody's dreamer, and I do not want to be referred to as dreamer. But I respect the safety and the ability for people to use that word.
Yeah. Because and something that I feel like this weekend in Chicago, where we spoke to the reporter,
Sisiki.
She mentioned something that stuck with me and I wrote it down. She mentioned to learn how to pick your battles. I think there are certain things in your life, in either immigration or politics or whatnot, you just have to choose when to pick your battles. If they're willing to support your cause and give you grants, but sometimes they call you dreamers in events when you see them, then that's fine. As long as I have the resources that I need to help my community, I think that's helping me do the work that I need to. So just things like these, I just wanted to share that resonated for me this
weekend.
I'm
such a fighter against that. I'm so the opposite. I'm like, don't.
Yeah.
Because I just have this strong ingrained connotation that this model minority thing is so engraved into that.
It
so
is.
I have a hard time with that. And I get even annoyed within our circle when they identify us as dreamers. And I always notice it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I always, always notice it, but I don't really say anything because I'm...
You're picking your battles.
I could make a scene about it, or I could fucking move on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yudiana, I wanted... I had asked Steve why he didn't go to the Rio Grande Valley. You did end up coming, but you almost didn't. And then you did. And I know that was a very intense emotional experience. And I'm gonna give it away. They're both cancers, so they're in their feels at all times. So,
and being a cancer and being in your feels is all right. Okay,
it is.
Well, now that something that stood out to me when you mentioned about actually your undergrad, what your undergrad degree was, which was UX design and engineer, and my undergrad when I first went to college was actually psychology. I always had this thing where I knew I wanted to help someone or be empathetic. I knew I had some sort of empathetic skill that I wanted to use. And UX design is so centered on human design, and psychiatry is as well. So I just wanted to tell you how powerful that is in terms of you're doing what you were taught in the work that you're doing now. You are problem solving and being in the field and being with your mentees and knowing what the issues are, so you can create better programs for our community. So just wanted to give you a heads up.
That's cool. No, that's really cool. Yeah. Honestly, like I'm not even biased, but my favorite zodiac is our cancers.
It is mine too. Not even biased.
But you know, like I think, you know, I'm learning too. Like every single day, we learn how to be better people, and we learn how to like take care of each other and serve others. And I think that one of the main reasons is because I have this like natural calling to serve other people. Yeah. You know, it's like, same. Yes, I do it because I need to, as being undocumented. And I also do it because it calls to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry. So, Yudiana, I'm going to just quickly ask again, like, what was your experience at the Rio Grande Valley like?
So it's really difficult because, you know, the Rio Grande Valley is basically the border, right? So it's like McAllen and Brownsville. And the last time that I was at the border was when I was coming to the U.S. And so there was a few things of why I couldn't have made it, right? One, I still vividly remember coming to the U.S., and the second part was I didn't have my DACA, I didn't have the actual
hard copy
of the DACA. And I know that folks said, if you don't have your DACA, don't come. And people specifically told me that. And I was like, oh, but I still want to go. And so really it was this internal battle of like, do I risk it? Do I go? This is an important place. I know that there's going to be a lot of emotions. And how do I do this? And I like also love the group. And so if I were to do anything, if I were to go to the border, it would be with you guys. Like it wouldn't be with anybody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you know, there was a lot of emotions that we all felt as we were physically present I believe it was Brownsville, right? We were in Brownsville.
Yeah, we were in Brownsville.
At Alice Park. But I remember, like, you feeling angry. And
Yeah. And
I could feel that from you, and I could see it because...
Well, even thinking about it now makes me, like, really angry. I'm, like, so, like, enraged the fact that something can be so close distance wise and me not be able to touch it.
Mm.
Like, you know, like we can walk across the street right now and touch something. And then there I was in the US, and then 2 feet away was Mexico. Yes. And I just wanted to touch it. Like, I just wanted to feel it. I just wanted to touch it. I just wanted to be there. And I knew I couldn't. I knew I couldn't do that because if I did that, there would be consequences, right?
Mm.
And I was just mad. I was like, fuck you all. Like I was in my head, I was trying to see how I could come up with ideas of how to like go over the barrier or go over the wall.
I remember you saying this.
Yeah. And so I'm like, oh, so like if I use a listón and like, I climb up, or, you know, I could have like gloves and like they could have a good grip and I could climb over. Like, I'm not even joking about how technical I was getting about how do I get over this barrier. I think that's a little bit of my like analytical side, like my engineering side. And I was mad, I was upset, like, and I'm not gonna lie to you all, like, I was upset, all of you, I was like, I'm upset at the world, I'm upset at all of you.
Yeah.
I don't want to be with you right now, like, just take me 10 feet across, like.
It's very emotional.
Well, I think it's so powerful how you have so much anger and fury because of this, but you haven't let it take over you. And that says a lot.
Yeah.
That says a lot.
The only thing that I was like, you know, like we said in the group too, like, you could hear the birds and you can feel the air. Like, you're like, you're so free. Like,
is there anything else either of you want to say about that?
I think that.
I think it's a good experience. I think going to the border had to happen. Like, for me personally, it had to happen. Because even though that was in the place where I came across, I was like, that river? Fuck, you took my shoe. You took my shoe in 2000. Where is it? You know, like, and so, like, you, like, have to see it and be like, oh, this was real. Because for a long time, I thought it was a dream, and I'm not done. Like, I'm not done healing from it, and I'm not done me being like, oh, it's okay that we have these barriers, because it's not okay. Like, fuck your fucking borders and fuck your immigration crisis. You fucking did this. Like, you know, like, I'm not done being mad. The only time that I did, like, because I was so mad that I was just like angry and holding in all my feelings, the only time that I was able to like really release was when I saw my dad's face. And so I called him and I FaceTimed him, and my dad, you know, who's in Washington, Eastern Washington, when I think about the many stories that he told me when he was crossing the border, and when I think about everything that he sacrificed and all the work that he's done, like, for me and my brothers, I'm like, esto no es nada. Like, whatever I'm going through is nothing compared to what you have gone through. And the man, like, the man that my dad is and how kind he is, I'm like, that's who I want to be, and that's how I see, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when I cried, like, finally, when I got to see him. I was like, I want to go home.
Well, not to switch the topic so quickly, but we have a whole group of other Dream Lead fellows waiting on us and have a lot more to go through. But again, like, thank you for sharing that and being vulnerable, and that's not fucking easy. And, you know, it just, again, goes back to what you said, is we are fucking resilient as people. Through the anger, through the sadness, through everything, we still push and push ahead, whether it's for us or for other people. We're just killing it. I have a few more questions for you all as we wrap up. So the first question is, and I think this one's important because a lot of people are curious about this, and you brought it up, and it was, how do you empower people to want to make social justice change and be advocates for immigrant communities be advocate for Muslim folks, for Black folks, etc. Like, that is such, we could do a whole fucking episode on that.
Oh yeah.
But you know what? We're just gonna touch on it.
Let's touch
on
it.
And have another one someday soon.
Hey, yes. I'm down
but
for that.
Let's hear it. Let's hear it. What do we have to do?
Yes, because actually just in the period of me talking to you today, like, I realized what made me take action was that I was mad. That I was enraged about what was happening. What inspires me is something that makes me mad. That I'm like, that's not okay. And so for people, like, get fucking pissed off. Like, get upset about what's happening.
You're too comfortable.
You're way too fucking comfortable. Like, if you're not upset about what's happening right now in your communities, if you're not upset at what's happening in your state, if you're not upset about what's happening in your fucking country, what the fuck? No, like, this is not normal. Us having to live this much trauma is not normal. And I would want to hope that there is something better, right? And so get upset and get active. Like, don't sit back and wait for somebody else to do something that you know that you can do.
And a lot of the times it means being present. It means doing the tedious phone calls and emails and, mm-hmm. you know, giving money. Like, you know, that is.
Yeah. So, like, think about, like, what can you do? What's in your capacity, right? Like, also, like, don't overdo it because you've got to take care of you. First person is you. But what can you do? And if you're not doing anything and you know you can, like, my girl, my dude, like, my person, like. Get to it.
Yeah.
Let's hear it, Steve. This was your question.
Yeah, and I mentioned to you that this was my question because I didn't know what the answer was. But now that Urianna mentioned that, I completely agree. Is that fury and anger that really drives us? For me, it was the separation of my family and being detained and that trauma and experience. And I wonder if there is another way where we don't have to be traumatized and we don't have to be angry and frustrated to take action. Like, why do we have to get to that point? Mm-hmm. Why do we have to get to that point? And what does that look like? Is it part of the human experience? Is it a balance? Where can we go forward using love as a way to keep pushing us? So it's a question and question, and it's something that we can talk about in as we dive deeper next time.
Yeah, for sure. And so my last question for you all. Actually, I have two more questions, but this is our famous question that we ask everybody. And we were actually laughing. I forgot who I was laughing with about this. It was Angelica. And I was like, have you noticed that it's a different answer every single time? And she was like, yeah, like, that is amazing. Like, that is one, like, she really enjoyed that. So I'm going to ask you and you, like, what does your liberation look like?
My liberation looks like not being in the U.S.
Do you want to unpack that a little more, or is that good?
So one of my goals is to make sure that at some point, not soon, but, you know, in like about 5 years, for me to be able to go somewhere else and not be afraid of being documented or undocumented. And so whether policy changes in the next 5 years, I've waited 19 years for policy to change, and it hasn't. So if it doesn't change in the next 5 years, freedom and liberation looks like me not being in the U.S.
Thanks for sharing that.
Mm.
Steve, what does your liberation look like?
That is a packed question. my liberation is something that I keep saying, but when we talk about immigration rights, immigration organizing, and immigration advocacy, I really have parallels to it, to my multicultural and multinational experience. Immigration rights, immigrant advocacy, and immigrant organizing is about accepting all the intersectionalities that we have. Immigration rights is women's rights, is Black Lives Matter, is LGBTQ rights, is all the social justice issues that we're fighting today. We are doing that. We are fighting for queer people to be accepted, for women's rights, for people of color, for us to have the freedom that we deserve. So my liberation is tied to all of you. And that fight will just keep to continue until we're all liberated.
Ooh. Thank you.
Yeah, fuck.
That was
good.
Yeah,
he had
thank
this
you,
plan.
Steve.
He was
like,
thinking
no,
about this.
Steve, like, I'm like, man, yes.
You're like, fuck all y'all.
Fuck
and
all
Steve's
of
like,
you.
I'm tied to all of you. Oh my god.
You can see like the different stages in our lives. You know, and like that's beautiful. And also like us Cancers, we like yeah.
Yeah.
Can be moody AF or nurturing AF.
All right, so we're gonna do our selfish plug. Let's hear it. What do you want to share with the world? What do you want to share? Your Instagram handle, your social media? What do you want? Or what do you want to tell people to do? Whatever, you know?
Yeah, no, like, so definitely, you know, I went to the East Coast. Now I'm back in Washington. Really trying to be, trying to think what my role is in being involved, right, in the community. But the conference is still happening, so the Beyond HB 1079 conference. And really funny story, so we have the name Beyond HB 1079 because in early 2011, we decided it's not just okay for us to have in-state tuition. What do we need as undocumented people? And so that conference is still happening. It's going to be community-led, happening on October 5th. So please mark your calendars. All undocumented people everywhere, not even just in Washington, everywhere, come out. Like, you know, it's really going to be a celebration of us and a celebration of undocumented students being able to access higher education. So that's my shameless plug. Another shameless plug is you can add me on Instagram, YurianaGT
we'll link it on our show notes.
Yeah, at YurianaGT.
Awesome. And let's hear it, Steve. What's your selfish plug? And just so you all know, Steve's a model. And he's hot as fuck.
Follow him on Instagram.
Follow him on Instagram. We're doing your selfish plug for you, but you know.
Okay. Well, you can feel free to do it for me as well. But I think my selfish plug will be that I'm also part of this docu-series that follows five other dreamers called Waking Dream. It's currently on YouTube or Facebook Watch. So definitely check it out if you want to learn more. Is about six stories of undocumented, documented individuals who are really navigating this issue. And it's six very different stories. We have some twins who are joining the military. We have people who are professors and my story as well, family separation. And also, I was part of a publication called Dream Supported, if you want to learn more about the story of my detention center experience. Definitely check that book out. It's by the UCLA Labor Center, and the title is Dream Supported. It's part of the third installation of books started by the UCLA Center that follows the chronicles, the story of the Dream Act movement in California.
Those.
Yeah.
I've seen those.
You're all going to have to email me all these links so I can link them out.
We'll do.
All right. Is there anything else y'all would like to say before we close out?
We love you,
Vicky. Aww, thank you so much.
Whatever.
Oh, thank you so much for this.
I'll die of love.
And thank you so much for sharing all your gifts.
All right. Well, cheers, Voodoo Rangers.
Cheers.
This has been a Pseudoscience production.